and welcome to The Past and Stuff, the history podcast with Ashley Bozian and Tracy Cooper, where we talk about stuff in the news, our pieces of stuff, and stuff in our lives.
So, hello, Ashley.
Hello, Tracy. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm hanging in there. Not bad. I'm surviving.
Do you still remember your name?
That one I do remember, but unfortunately not much else.
Okay. Yeah. How many weeks is it? How many weeks have you got left to go before the end of the semester?
I think we're a little more than halfway through. So I don't know. 4, 10, 12. I don't know.
Whatever. Number.
A bunch of them.
Okay. So for my stuff in the news this week, we are heading to a very remote hillside in Colorado, where this week, people on the antique Durango to Silverton narrow gauge railroad spotted, filmed, and photographed Bigfoot.
Dun, dun, dun. I heard about this. One of my students was telling me about this. Okay. All right. And it was really him.
Yeah.
Yes.
I have a little bit of video to share with you. So ooh. We've never done this before, so I'm not so sure if it's actually going to work. So let me go to share screen.
That's okay. We'll just pretend it worked in editing. Oh, I see it.
You see it. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So this is only like 18 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
Can you see it? Can you see the Bigfoot?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's moving.
Just sat down.
About worked.
Yay. So it wasn't very long.
Wait.
It's not very impressive.
I don't see Bigfoot. I just see a landscape.
Okay. It's like right in the center. So very long way away, very blurry. And probably not the most impressive thing you've ever seen.
But yeah, I'm not
definitely
convinced.
Definitely something. Okay. I have a couple
that could have been like, I don't know, an especially well-fed coyote.
A bipedal coyote. Okay.
It didn't necessarily look bipedal to me, but it could just be that it was grainy and blurry. I don't know.
All right. I have a couple of images as well.
Okay.
So let me share those with you. There's one of the Colorado creature, I'm going to call him.
Oh.
And this is one of them squatting down.
Okay. All right. That's more convincing. That's a face. It looks ape-like and somewhat man-like. Okay. That's Bigfoot. Yeah.
That's Bigfoot, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so let me set the scene for you. A couple celebrating their 10th wedding anniversary called Shannon and Stetson Parker. And I just have to pause there and say what an awesome name Stetson Parker is. It's real Americana, as American as Bigfoot, and it's the kind of name that British people expect all American men to have. Anyway, love your name, Stetson. Anyway, so Shannon and Stetson Parker went for a ride on this historic train, which was, as I said, was the Durango and Silverton Narrow Gauge Railway. And this has been running on this 45-mile branch of the original Denver and Rio Grande Railway since 1882. So it's a little steam train. The train trip looks amazing. It's about 3.5 hours long each way, narrow gauge steam train, leaving the Durango Depot and venturing into the wilderness of the Rocky Mountains with views of the San Juan National Forest as the train winds its way along the beautiful Animas River on its way to the historic mining town of Silverton. And according to Wikipedia, the population of Silverton is just 622 people. Mm-hmm. And the entire town is a federally designated National Historic Landmark.
Huh.
So to give you some idea of just how remote and unpopulated this area is, Silverton is the only incorporated town in the entire San Juan County. And it's only got a population of 622.
Huh.
So this means it's the only town with elected officials. So from photographs, Silverton looks just beautiful. It's got one main street with 100 or so buildings in a flat valley, totally dwarfed by mountains on all sides with the snow on the top of the mountains.
Oh.
And remember, this is the destination of the train ride. The 45 miles of train sort of goes through what's mostly an empty scenery, apart from these train tracks that run alongside the river. So the name of the town, Silverton, is named for silver mining. It was first sort of inhabited by white people in 1860, following these silver mining claims. So that's towards the end of the Colorado Gold Rush, which was 1858 to 1861. And of course, there were people in these lands before the Silverton Silver Rush, and these were the Utes occupying the Great Basin area. And the Utes inhabited...
Sorry, I have to interrupt you to say, was it the two Utes? Just two of them?
The Utes?
The two Utes. What movie was that? Was it My Cousin Vinny?
I don't know.
Oh my gosh! It's now that we might have to edit this out because it's like super racist against a whole bunch of people. But it's like this Italian-American, like Bronx kind of, you know. Yeah, the two Utes. He's trying to say youths. Like young people.
Okay, yeah, I remember.
Yeah, and the judge is like, Utes, what are Utes? And there's this whole thing. So that's what that made me think.
I was actually trying to think where I heard the term Utes from, and it's actually spelled U-T-E-S, and I looked up on Google the pronunciation of it, and it's it is Utes. I was like, where did I remember that from? It could have been from My Cousin Vinny. Mm-hmm. Or a Ute is what Australians call their SUVs.
Huh.
They're utility vehicles. So they're called
That makes sense. Like as an abbreviation. I can see that.
And I listen to a lot of Australian true crime, so that's anyway, no disrespect to the
none at all
great to Native American people, the Utes.
Or Italian Americans.
Italian American Utes. Utes. The Utes inhabited a vast area, not only of what is now Colorado, but also Utah, Wyoming, eastern Nevada, northern New Mexico, and Arizona, in that great basin area that crosses the edges of so many states. So one thing that's interesting about the Utes and this Great Basin area is that there are many pictographs from this area of a creature that looks like Bigfoot. It's a huge creature, shaggy creature on two legs. So these sightings may not be anything new in this area. Although when we usually think about Bigfoot, we're usually thinking about the West Coast, the northern parts of the West Coast, Washington State and things like that. Anyway, back to the Parker's anniversary trip. And if my background here has not sufficiently impressed you on how empty this area is, and you're a great big nerd like I am, I suggest that you do as I did and follow the train tracks from Durango to Silverton on Google Earth. It's Google Earth is my sort of I can't sleep, let me look at something on Google Earth thing.
That's anyway, pretty cool. It's like you get to travel without having to leave your bed.
Yeah. Well, it's 3:37 in the morning. Time to go to Mozambique.
What else are you going to do?
Yeah, I keep thinking I'm going to discover, you know, a lost city or something.
Maybe you will.
Or Bigfoot waving at the camera.
Even better.
Anyway, there are no roads along this train track route. There are few buildings as you get outside of Durango anyway. No buildings. Maybe the odd trail, but that might be an animal trail or a dirt track, but it's mostly just completely wild. And then there's the scrubland and then dense forest and then the high peaks. And if you were to travel between Durango and Silverton as the crow flies and not along the river, Mount Eolus is on the way, and that's a peak of 14,090 feet. So wilderness, wilderness, wilderness.
Sounds nice.
Yeah, it sounds lovely. I really want to do this now. Probably just go backwards and forwards on the train trying to spot Bigfoot for 2 weeks.
I mean, I'll be honest. I don't know if I could take it. I'd very quickly be like, where's the nearest Starbucks?
But, does Silverton have a Starbucks? That says the
I mean, I would definitely follow you on Google Earth for sure while sipping on my Starbucks.
Anyway, on their way back from Silverton, Shannon asked Stetson to help her try to spot elk. You know, they're supposed to be able to see elk in this region. And what they spotted instead, as I just showed you on the video and the pictures here we're looking at, was something far stranger. A very tall, quite thin, very hairy figure strolling along the hillside. So Shannon took some photographs. That's what we're looking at here. And a fellow passenger shot some video. So like more than one set of people saw this. And it's actually quite a long way away from the train. It's not like right on the train track at all, which kind of gives me the idea it might have some veracity. I think if somebody was going to hoax, they'd be closer and make sure that people could see them. Anyway, so
yeah, that was my thought. Like maybe it was someone who just like did dressed up like this as a prank, but it seems awfully difficult to do considering how, you know, wildernessy that is.
Yeah, I mean, you'd have to take an ATV or something out there and just hang out on the hillside for a long time. Sort of, it's like, looks like it's like quarter of a mile or so away from where the train is. It's a long way. You know, this figure's actually really tiny in the video without it being blown up.
True. Although there are some YouTube pranksters who would definitely go through all that trouble for this.
Maybe. There's some people with little to do in their life and don't have Google Earth on their phone. You know, that would be what
or jobs.
So neither the video or the photographs are great quality. As I said, they're taken from a moving train and they're focused in on this figure that's quite some distance away. So in the video, the creature walks a few paces and then squats down, adjusts a little, and then rocks backwards and forwards a little. We've seen the video kind of blown up as much as you can. So this could actually be the first footage of Bigfoot taking a dump. That's just what it looks like to me.
I was gonna say that and I was like, nah, I have a PhD, I can't say that out loud.
I have tenure, I can. So anyway, I think someone,
and that's needs academia in a nutshell, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, so true. So anyway, someone needs to head up onto this hillside right away with a pooper scooper and grab some poop for DNA testing. Anyway,
that's what you should have done with your sabbatical.
Anyway, a little more detail can be seen in Shannon's photograph than the video. And the one we've seen here on one side is creature walking, and the other is of the creature sitting. The walking one shows it's got longer arms, I think, than a man's would be, and very broad shoulders. And you can see a domed head, quite a distinctive domed head. And then in the seated photo, which is also zoomed in and quite blurry, you can see the same high domed head and a hairless face, like you were saying, like an ape face. So the press has been buzzing about this with the usual speculation and people coming down into one of three camps. It's either an elaborate hoax, a misidentification, or a genuine sighting. So let's start with misidentification. Could this simply be a hunter in a ghillie suit? Do you know what a ghillie suit is?
I have heard of it. And when I heard about this from my student, they mentioned that theory. And I said, what's a ghillie suit? And they told me, and I forgot. What's a ghillie suit? I'll ask you again.
So a ghillie suit is a kind of camouflage clothing worn by outdoorsy hunter types. I've actually got a picture here for you. That's a ghillie suit on sale on Amazon.
That's like a Cousin It costume.
It is. It does look a little like a Cousin It costume. And this is the mossy light brown color. So it's kind of a similar color to the Colorado creature, which is a trademark. I made that word up. But it doesn't really look, I don't think it looks very similar.
And also the face, right? That's like the big important thing, the face. Yeah. And the height. The size of it.
And the size of it, yeah. So part of the thing with a ghillie suit is you cover the face. You don't want, you know, you're supposed to be a shrub. You're supposed to be out there looking like a shrub. I think a person in a ghillie suit would come across as far shaggier and far more bulky. And the Colorado creature actually has quite skinny arms and legs. And the fur is also quite sleek looking. And also, I don't see any sign of a gun or a bow, which you would, you know, especially when the creature squats down, you would see it move that around in some way. And then, as you said, there's also the height. I mean, it's very difficult at the distance that the video is shot at to judge exactly how tall this thing is, but it looks tall. And the domed head and the hairless face.
So and the proportions, I'm not... too. Hmm? Like the really long arms, the proportions of the body, right? Like that's not a human.
Yeah. But I just got to say, if this is a guy in a ghillie suit, he needs to be really careful. Because right now there's probably a bunch of other hunters out there trying to bag themselves as a Bigfoot. And I looked up the legalities of this. And in Washington State, it's actually illegal to shoot Sasquatch.
Huh.
It's a crime.
That's a great law.
It is a great law. And in Texas, it's perfectly legal to shoot their version of the elusive humanoid, the skunk ape.
I'm not surprised by that at all.
No.
Texas.
And so the law in Colorado isn't quite clear, but, you know, a law ain't going to protect you from a bunch of eager hunters wanting to bag the first Bigfoot. So if it is a guy in a ghillie suit, don't do this again for a while. But personally, that's my advice. And everybody listens to this show.
Well, they should. They get good advice from it.
Yeah. But personally, I am not convinced by the ghillie suit argument. So that brings us to the hoax. Now, some people have claimed that they can see sunglasses. And I don't think so. I think what you're looking at there is just shading from a large brow ridge. It's not the black of a sunglass.
There's no glare either. Yeah. There's no reflection.
Yeah, that's a good point. And then others have said that the fur looks too shiny to be a Bigfoot.
Maybe Bigfoot just has a really shiny coat. He gets a lot of protein.
Yeah, and I would like to say lots of animals have very shiny coats, including my kitty.
And my dogs.
Mm-hmm. And I looked at some pictures of chimps. And very often when we see pictures of chimps, they're in trees and things like this. So it's not, the sun isn't shining on them. But I looked at some chimps. I had to Google chimps in the sunshine.
Oh, that sounds nice.
It is. And I looked at a lot of pictures of chimps. And their coats actually gleam in the sunshine, particularly on the back. So, you know, in my very, very amateur anthropologist stance there, I would say if there is a Bigfoot, there's no problem with him having a gleaming coat.
Yeah, so that tracks.
Others have said that the behavior of squatting and then adjusting is not something that an animal would do.
Well, if he's a slightly humanoid animal like Bigfoot is, then he might.
Yeah. My next comment was, to which I say, huh? Unless a primate expert tells me that an ape would never adjust itself when it squats, I am not even sure what this person is talking about. I think any squatting animal, finding a bit of foliage, poking it in the gonads, will move around and so it's not uncomfortable.
Yeah, I mean, our dogs even do that when they squat down.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, none of this internet chatter of the naysayers, of course, precludes the idea that this is a deliberate hoax.
Mm-hmm.
With a convincing dome-headed costume worn by a particularly tall Coloradian with not much to do. There have been hoaxes in the past. There will be hoaxes in the future. People like stirring things up. They like being part of the story. And sometimes they believe so much that they really want other people to believe too. And so they think it's necessary to fabricate proof. That's a certain type of person.
Yeah, like so, the guy with the Piltdown Man.
Yeah, and even that guy with the little fake alien bodies that I talked about. The reason people hoax is a very fascinating topic. I think it's like the same people, same as those people that insert themselves needlessly into criminal cases. It's a certain kind of thing that's wrong with them. But anyway, Bigfoot belief is actually on the rise. So I looked at this website called Civic Science, and between 2020 and 2022, belief in Bigfoot rose 18%.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So the COVID months. You're stuck inside. You've watched everything else on Netflix. You decide to watch Finding Bigfoot or one of the many hundreds of Bigfoot shows, and you become a believer. That's what I think is going on there.
Fair enough.
But now 13% of adults in America agree with the statement Bigfoot / Sasquatch is a real living creature. So let's break this down a little bit. More people on the West Coast are believers than on the East Coast. So 15% on the West Coast, 11% on the Northeast. And the increase in believers has actually come from urban and suburban populations. But rural populations still remained the highest at 14%. And by age, the increase was among Gen Xers, people 35 to 54 years old. So Bigfoot believers, moreover, are one, more likely to visit state and national parks. Of course they are. They're looking for Bigfoot. Two, more likely to be daily YouTube users. Of course they are. They're looking for Bigfoot. Three, play a musical instrument. I don't know. Ashley, do you want to?
Yeah, being a musician myself, I can clearly say that their music is trying to lure out Bigfoot. They're trying to draw him out.
Okay, they're up there with their lute trying to lure out Bigfoot.
Yeah, like a snake charmer, a Sasquatch charmer.
Mm-hmm. So they're more likely to invest in cryptocurrency, again.
Of course they are.
Believing in things that don't exist. They're more likely to believe in the Loch Ness Monster. They're more likely to have enjoyed the X-Files.
Right.
And own a gun.
That's right. Yeah, I'm not surprised. That makes sense to me.
Okay, so we can see that person.
Yeah.
You can just close your eyes and you can see that's 13% of Americans with those traits that believe in Bigfoot.
At least.
So, of course, none of this increases the likelihood that the Colorado creature is indeed a genuine Bigfoot sighting. But it does show that the cultural phenomena of Bigfoot has a really firm hold in the American psyche and that it's increasing. And as a cultural historian, this is something that I think can and should be studied and thought about, whether or not Bigfoot is actually real. The willingness and the desire to believe in something beyond our everyday is part of our human condition. Whether it's UFOs, Bigfoot, angels, fairies, or God, or gods and goddesses. You might question like whether the belief in God is the same as the belief in Bigfoot. Well, let me show you a picture. All I believe is Bigfoot, is God and Bigfoot. This is a sweatshirt that, of course, enough people want to wear that people are actually manufacturing it. And it shows a wooden cross with a Bigfoot silhouette in the front foreground. And then surrounding it, it says, all I believe is God and Bigfoot. So,
okay. So I just have to tell you my first thought when I saw this image, I was about to say, I don't know why, but I think I know why. My first thought was Arkansas.
Arkansas. I don't know if Arkansas actually has a humanoid type creature, but maybe. God and Bigfoot. And now actually, talking about this as a cultural historian now, there are actually quite a lot of websites out there that look at the Bible for proof of Bigfoot.
The Bible wasn't set in the Pacific Northwest.
But they look at things like Genesis 25:25. So Esau, of course, was covered in hair. And his descendants, the Edomites, well, they could all be Bigfoot.
That just means he was probably Armenian.
And then, of course, there's Cain, who God condemned for murdering his brother, quote, a restless wanderer on the earth. That's Genesis 4:12. And then finally, there are the Nephilim.
Genesis the giants, 6:4, yeah.
The race of giants produced by the union of the fallen angels and human women. Now, don't get me wrong. I am not saying that the Bible proves Bigfoot. But what it does prove is an ancient fascination with the idea of a race apart, the idea of a Bigfoot-like creature, of somehow there are other humanoids out there not quite like us, is, you know, in the Bible and, you know, current. So it's something that I think it demonstrates the human capacity to believe in something and believe in something that they have not necessarily had firsthand experience of, something that's not necessarily provable. And the desire to believe in this, that it fulfills some need in the human psyche to believe in this and to find like-minded people. And in the age of the internet, this culture of belief is changing. So what we're looking at is not just about cultural history, but also the history of communications and how people sort of pass on their beliefs. You know, it's not just within a village or tribe anymore. You know, you find your own tribe on the internet, and there's a whole tribe out there of Bigfoot believers, I guess. So I think belief in Bigfoot is actually, from a cultural historian's point of view, an important part of the story of what makes us human. You know, it has a validity to study this. Mm-hmm. And if this is going to be my third book, it might be the only one that makes money. So so Bigfoot is a very ancient and a very modern idea at the same time. The ability to believe and disbelieve, or to keep those two opposing views under scrutiny at the same time, that's a crucial part of the human condition. So I want to finish up today thinking about science after talking about, you know, belief, and without engaging in any ideas that are out there that Bigfoot can turn invisible or shift dimensions. So my question is it possible for Bigfoot to exist without actually answering what it is? Is it, you know, is it an ape? Is it a bear? Is it a humanoid? Is it, you know, so one of the factors in this is wilderness, and researchers estimate that only about 23% of the Earth's surface is now pristine wilderness, so untouched by human modification.
Wow.
But 23% is actually quite a lot.
Yeah, that's almost a quarter.
Yeah, it's 45 million square miles. That's a lot of area to hide a Sasquatch or a Yeti or a Bigfoot in, you know, it's big. And 70% of wilderness is actually concentrated in just five countries. Russia, Canada, the United States, Brazil, and Australia. Okay. All of which have, you know, histories of humanoid creature sightings. We don't have to even assume that an area needs to be totally devoid of people, totally absent of human beings, for a Bigfoot to survive in that area. So if we look at indigenous cultures have, you know, traditionally managed land in a way that doesn't decrease biodiversity. It's only really, you know, in the modern period, in the last 150 years or so, and with a lot of European colonization, that vast areas of lands have been managed in a way that decreases biodiversity. So good land management, good traditional indigenous land management, Even though there are people there, Bigfoot and other things could still survive there. They're not necessarily going to be driven out by the way that the land is managed. So I was looking at this website called nativelanguages.org, and I was looking for, you know, words in Native American languages for Bigfoot. They start with a caveat, which is Bigfoot enthusiasts have labeled just about every mythological creature ever known in the Western Hemisphere as another name for Sasquatch. And these include, quote, names for giants, dwarves, ghosts, gods, underwater monsters, four-legged predators, an enormous bird, and a disembodied flying head. So, you know, they're a little tongue-in-cheek. They're saying, you know, not every creature is a Sasquatch. But while they make this caveat, they do go on to list the name for a, quote, wild hairy man of the forest that is human-sized or slightly taller in 24 native languages, mostly from the Pacific Northwest region. Wow. And this does include the term Sasquatch, which is from the Coast Salish Indians. And this has come to be used as a blanket term, but it's only really one people that use that term. There are terms in 24 other languages as well. So to the Chihalis, the hairy man is the Siatko. To the Chinook, it's the Skookum. To the Dene, it's a Kakani. And to the Chickasaw, the hairy man is Loafer. So my point here being that we should not expect the necessity of a totally untouched wilderness for a Bigfoot habitat. So a hairy man, this Bigfoot, doesn't have to be somewhere that no one else has ever been. And in fact, the fact that there are so many different words and not even similar sounding words in so many different native languages suggests to me, at least, that the word was necessary. The word was needed to describe a thing. And it wasn't a word connected to a myth, a story, or an archetype that was then shared and passed between different language groups, or the word would be similar, like griffin or something like that we were talking about. And the names are for the hairy man don't mean the same things in the different languages. And they run the gamut of benign to malevolent, just the same as the hairy man stories do. So the Chickasaw word loafer actually means flayer or skinner.
Hardcore.
Straight there. So a reference to the hairy man's a gruesome habit of flaying the skin from his victims. And the Cheyenne word is Maximista, which means big monster or big spirit being, a powerful and dangerous being, but also a shy one that's likely to stay out of people's way. And the Sioux word is Chayi Tanka, which means big elder brother. So a more benign word. And then the actual word Sasquatch, as I said, was from the Salish. They don't actually use that word. They use the English euphemism stick Indians rather than saying Sasquatch, because they think that saying the name is taboo. And in some tribes, it's thought to provoke attacks.
Like Beetlejuice. You don't want to say it three times.
Yeah, exactly. So, of course, this is a lot of nuance. And it's lost by, you know, white people generically using the term Sasquatch. But it is in this nuance and the difference that I think that actually lends a little bit of credence to the idea that different people were naming something that they at least thought was out there, that they at least thought was real and describable. So my last point is about population. How many Bigfoots, does it take to make a viable population? And this put me in mind of the stuff in the news you did a few weeks back about the human population having arrived at a bottleneck of 1,300, I think.
Yeah.
And staying like there that, for quite a long time, but surviving at the end of this. So I can't say I've completely figured out a definitive answer to how many big feet does it take to have a viable population. And there is there seem to be disagreement amongst biologists. But there are two figures that seem to reoccur. So, and these are like 50 to 100. You need 50 to 100 for a species to survive. But you need 500 to 1,000 to prevent genetic drift. Do you know what genetic drift is?
Not exactly. I mean, I'm inferring it's something like genetic bottlenecking, but is it different?
Yeah, it's genetic bottlenecking. It's you only have so few examples of different alleles left that those alleles can die out within like five generations because they're not being selected. So so that second number, as I said, is about genetic drift, 500 to 1,000. So if a population hits a population bottleneck, so it contracts in a very short period of time, say, you know, by the arrival of white people in California and Colorado, so since like 1850, then the survival of individuals might be random. There's no sort of genetic advantage anymore. So there's no natural selection. It's just, you know, god-awful randomness, whether a creature survives to pass on its genes or not. So you're not getting the best alleles like you normally would. And these individuals have fewer variety of mates. And so certain alleles become dominant and others die out. But this doesn't mean that it's impossible for big feet to exist at all. I don't think we can say definitively yes or no whether it's possible, even if they ever did exist. But I think we can say like a population necessary to prevent genetic drift, 500 to 1,000. I don't see any problem for that amount of creatures to survive historically in the wilderness of America, if they ever existed. I don't think necessarily in terms of viable population, they would necessarily have been have died out. They may have survived historically for thousands of years, long enough to have been named and painted by Native Americans. But then if these were massively impacted by a bottleneck event, like the arrival of white people who like to mess with land in restrictive ways, they could still exist, but in smaller and smaller pockets. You know, you need 50 to carry on a species, but over a few generations, you could probably get by. You could limp along for another 100 years or so with just a few, just a family or so, you know, with a lot of inbreeding, of course. So I don't think we necessarily have to say it would be impossible. Whether we believe or not, I think is a matter of personal choice until somebody comes up with something slightly more conclusive than the Bigfoot video that we've just been talking about. But as a cultural historian, I find the topic fascinating. The idea of humanoid myths, they're just everywhere. I mean, if we go back to the first work of fiction, the Gilgamesh, you know, we have Enkidu, the wild man in that, you know, and in Beowulf, there's Grendel, you know, there's myths out there. So I think I'm going to do an episode on that whole phenomenon of wild men, hairy men, whatever you want to call them, separately. But this was just my stuff in the news, which went on a bit too long today anyway. So, what's your stuff in the news?
Well, my stuff in the news is just as scary, although unfortunately we have confirmation that it's real. So maybe a little worse than yours. My stuff in the news today is that beginning in fall of 2025, American travelers to EU countries, and I think other countries too, I think possibly all Schengen countries, but I think they're still working out the kinks. Anyway, we will have to go through a dystopian series of border checks before we can enter the EU and possibly the entire Schengen zone. We're going to, in lieu of having our passport scanned, Now, just our faces and our fingerprints will be scanned.
Oh.
Yeah.
Horrifying.
Yep, horrifying. Yep.
Americans are going to be treated like they treat everyone else.
Pretty much.
I am not very sympathetic about this.
That's fair.
I've had, you know, as an immigrant, I've had to have my biometric information taken and, you know, stored by the government. And you know, I've got to go through that whole fingerprint, facial printing every time I come into America and leave again. And I have, and it's been about 10 years or so, more than 10 years now.
Wow.
That's been going on. Yeah.
Because you, that was before you became a citizen because you're an immigrant?
I'm not a citizen.
Oh, you're not. Okay.
I'm an alien.
Ooh.
Aliens exist. You're looking at one.
We should put you on that show. Except you're not ancient. Yeah, you're ancient aliens.
Thank you.
But I didn't know that they did that to. Wow.
Yeah.
That's horrifying.
And it's expensive as well. You have to pay for it yourself. You know, I think it was like $350 or something.
Each time?
Yeah, no, when you get the stuff taken and loaded in. I don't know, it was in my whole kind of, I paid a lawyer to do everything for me.
Okay, smart.
Because it's a terrifying, horrifying process, sort of applying for a green card. And it's just so confusing. And I have a PhD and that paperwork was just, it was a stack. And it, I don't know, they just didn't define terms and it was just crazy.
It was worse than submitting your dissertation to the library.
Oh, God. Yeah. Way worse.
Mother of God.
Way worse. It was like they wanted to know all this information about my paternal grandfather, which I didn't know.
What?
Yeah. You know, family background, family history, but I didn't know. I didn't even know his name.
I mean, sometimes that can't be helped. Like,
I know. And I was like, oh my goodness.
What if you're adopted? What if you don't know your family? Like,
yeah,
what?
I mean, it's so crazy. So anyway, so when I come back into America, I get scanned every time. Yeah,
wow, I didn't know that. Sympathy.
So Americans, it's like Americans have been doing this to people for a long time.
I actually didn't know that. And I'm quite angry to find that out. And the few articles I read about this, that didn't come up. It didn't come up that we've been doing this for quite a long time. It did come up that it's been happening in a few other places, but they kind of glossed over how we've been doing it. Like one of those places is here and the people we've been doing it to are immigrants.
Yeah, everyone.
Everyone, yeah.
Everyone who wants to stay longer than 30 days.
Yeah, that never came up. And it is horrifying. It shouldn't happen to anyone. Privacy advocates are extremely concerned. They're raising alarm bells, which they should have done when they started doing this to you guys, but it's okay. Now they are. And they're saying, you know, there are risks of identity theft and much worse than your average identity theft because they could steal like your fingerprints and your biometric information, your iris and stuff. Like what happens if somebody steals that? Like that's scary. That's why I don't use any of the biometric, stuff on my phone. Like I know people rely on it and they like it and that's fine, but for me I'm like I don't want Google to know my fingerprints. Like that just freaks me out.
No, I use it because I'm really trash at remembering passwords. I think it's a little safer than my passwords all being the same.
Yeah, I mean
everything.
Yeah, it's pretty dystopian. So the database that they've developed for this is called ETIAS or ETIAS. That's Echo, Tango, India, Alpha, Sierra, ETIAS or ETIAS. And it's one of the scary things about it is it's going to be administered or is administered by state governments.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Not federal government?
Like when I say state, I mean like European states, like European countries.
Oh, okay. I thought you meant like if it's going to be managed by U.S. state government.
But that would be even worse. That would be a complete shit show. Yeah, no, that would be completely inefficient. This will still be inefficient, but not as inefficient as if it were like United States governments. That would be terrible. But still pretty dystopian. It's going to store information about, obviously, your biometrics, your personal history, your travels, where else you've been, which I guess probably comes up when you scan a passport, but the passport doesn't have my, like, you know, iris and facial recognition on it. And this will automatically upload all of that information, or at least make it accessible to local law enforcement, which on one hand is like, if someone goes to another country and commits a crime, you want that information to be able to, you know, be pulled up right away. Mm-hmm. But it's also really scary for the vast majority of us who travel abroad and don't commit crimes.
Yeah.
And then it's kind of like, well, if I'm not going to commit a crime, what do I have to hide? And, you know, sure, nothing. But do I want them to have all that information? Like, do they really need it? That's a little uncomfortable. And it's opting out is not an option. Like, you cannot enter EU or Schengen countries without this, depending on, I'm not sure exactly which way they're going to spin it, but it's at least EU countries. This will be, so what you're going to have to do is, like, if you want to enter the EU after 2025, you're going to have to, in advance, enter all your information, your biometrics, kind of like what you were describing, what you did, and then have it all scanned once you arrive at the border, and it'll be checked against what you entered. And it's apparently going to go very quickly, but still very, very scarily. So happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween. And it makes for really big queues when you're trying to get through customs. Yeah, I was married to an American man, and he, you know, would go through being an American and be at the other side, like, on his third coffee by the time I'd got through all the rubbish I had to go through getting everybody's fingerprints scanned. And, you know, the poor people trying to explain to people coming into the country, you know, we're in a million languages, we're trying to scan your fingerprints and stand there while we photograph.
That's scary.
Yeah, but it's Big Brother, and it's global Big Brother, I guess, not just America being Big Brother.
It is. Come to think of it, when I was in England last year, I remember feeling freaked out that the machine had to scan my, like, I had to put my passport down on the thing to scan. And then while that happened, it also scanned my face. And I was like, this is horrifying. And then I quickly put it out of my mind, because I guess I didn't want to think about it anymore. And I didn't remember that again until just now. So for all I know, they probably have all my information.
Okay. I got one more story about how horrible the American government is. America.
There are a lot of stories about that, but yeah, go for your one. Okay. There.
So when you go to get a visa in London to come into the United States, they've got this very beautiful big building, the American Embassy, and then they've got these crash barriers, like concrete crash barriers. You know, so nobody drives a van full of bomb into the building.
I was going to say, for like terrorists.
Yeah, but then they make you queue on the other side of the barriers.
Of course they do.
So you're like, just in case somebody comes with a bomb, could you hit all these immigrants first rather than damage our crash barriers?
I mean, that sounds perfectly American to me. Like, this isn't breaking news to me.
It just offended me so much, you know.
It's called a human shield, Tracy. It's the most American thing we do.
Happy Halloween.
Dystopian government edition. Anyway, you like to share your piece of stuff with me? I think it's your turn to start.
It is. It is. Let me bring up my picture here. Here we go. And I'm using this picture. It's not the greatest one, but it was the one that was on Wikicommons. So I know I'm not going to violate any copyright by using it. So it's,
well, that's a good factor.
It's four pictures in one. What are you seeing?
Footprints.
Footprints. Yeah.
Are they Bigfoot?
No, they're actually human. But that was part of the joke of doing this episode, that you might think that they're Bigfoot, but they're actually human footprints.
Okay.
So what we're looking at here is from White Sands National Park in Mexico. Hello, this is the correction fairy. Tracy meant to say New Mexico. Thank you, carry on. Which is my background today as well.
Ooh.
And so it's a series of fossilized human footprints. We've got some very nice archaeologists there. I like the fact that this guy has a piece of gym mat to kneel down on. That's a seasoned archaeologist with bad knees. And you can see the two various levels of footprints. And you can see on the in the top right-hand side that there is, you know, footprints at different strata. So they've been left over different periods. So this brings together several threads. And I'm sorry, I didn't sort of give you a chance to guess what was going
on. No, I mean, there's like, that's pretty much all there is to see. It's footprints.
It's footprints. So this was going to be my stuff in the news this week. It ended up getting a bit long. But it brings together several threads that we've been discussing in past episodes, particularly about dating techniques. And it also shows the very fast-moving pace of prehistoric research. Because it seems that something that I said quite confidently last week, just last week, might in fact be wrong.
So I love when that happens. Where, like, something is true one week and then a discovery is made. And like, oh, it's not true anymore.
Yeah. So you remember that I said that humans and terror birds couldn't have met because terror bird died out a few thousand years before the first people arrived in the Americas?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it turns out I may have been wrong.
Yay.
Because it seems that people may have arrived in the Americas much earlier than we'd previously thought.
Ooh.
Yeah, big deal. So. Yeah. Traditionally, researchers believed that humans arrived in North America around 13,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And then this has been modified to about 16,000 years ago by some archaeological finds in the last 10 years or so. But this discovery that looking at here, these fossilized human footprints in the White Sands National Park, push back that date to between 20 and 23,000 years ago.
Wow.
So the important point about that date is this is during the last glacial maximum.
Mm-hmm.
This is not during a warm period. This is ice age stuff.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, if any of this seems vaguely familiar to any listeners, this will be because these footprints were actually found in 2009. And there's about 61 of them that were found at that time. And they're at the edge on the shore of what was then an ice age era lake called Lake Otero in the Tularosa Basin. Now, the Tularosa Basin is a graben basin, which just means it's a depressed block of land, an area of land that has been displaced downwards. So it has escarpments on each side. So another famous example would, of course, be the Great Rift Valley in East Africa, which, of course, is very, very famous for its hominid finds. So historically, the Tularosa Basin didn't look like this, didn't look like this background behind me, didn't look like a desert, because it's only looked like that since white people came and trashed it. So where once there were native bunch grasses, reportedly as high as a horse's shoulder, overgrazing in the 1880s caused real problems. So one cowboy in 1889 estimated that there were 85,000 head of cattle. And then the area was hit by a drought. And the ranchers, in order to try and keep this amount of cattle alive, pumped the sweet water out of the aquifer under the basin and left only the brackish water. So, of course, this leads to groundwater salination, and the area is now a desert. And the only things that really grow here are creosote bushes. So none of this really has anything to do with these footprints, except that the biome change enabled them to be found. You know, they're not under a bunch of grass. And I do like to talk about massive ecological mistakes. makes me feel superior or something.
They are entertaining.
So the footprints show that humans might have been stalking a giant sloth, a giant ground sloth, or a megatherium. Now, talk about Bigfoot, talk about a strange bipedal beast. this giant ground sloth has to be one of the strangest mammals that's ever walked the earth. So living relatives to the giant ground sloth include anteaters, armadillos, and of course, the much smaller modern tree sloth. Did you say sloth or sloth?
Sloth.
Sloth. Okay.
But you have a British accent, so anything you say is going to make it sound fancy. People will be like, yeah, that's right.
I've lived in this state so long now, I couldn't remember. I was trying to go, is it Sloth? Is it Sloth? Which is British? Which is American?
Well, that's like, you would think that it would be like, it would track everywhere, but then don't you guys call them scones? We call them scones. Aren't they scones to you?
Scones in the north, scones in the south.
Okay.
There you go.
Yeah, so it's like you never know which vowel sound you're going to get.
Just like my speech patterns, you never know which vowel sounds are going to pop out of my mouth at any particular time. So the obviously the very, very cute modern tree sloths are known for just hanging around in trees with their very long claws, having a very slow, low rate of metabolism and not really moving around very much at all. Now, the giant tree sloths, the great giant ground sloths, sorry, were much bigger, bigger than an elephant, maybe 10 to 20 feet long.
Wow.
And weighing about 4 tons. And not only they were quadrupeds, but they were capable of bipedal motion.
Okay.
Can you imagine like a 20-foot biped? That's just insane. That's very, yeah. Very Bigfoot. Anyway,
that's intense.
Got to get my head out of Bigfoot now. nobody's going to believe anything that I say. So they have these huge claws on their front feet, and they actually have on their skin what's known as dermal ossicles. So dermal ossicles are small nodules of bone on the skin. So this is usually found on reptiles. You can imagine the little knobbly bits on reptiles. Those are called dermal ossicles. And I just keep saying that because I love the way it feels in my mouth when I say it. I need to get a bard in Dungeons and Dragons and call them dermal ossicles.
Anyway. I feel like that should be like the song he sings.
So they're very, very rare on mammals. And they're seen today only on armadillos. So there are different species of giant sloth. And one of my favorite looking ones has no front teeth and instead has a small tubular snout. So like a micro trunk.
So okay.
The giant ground sloth really looks like something that Jim Henson invented.
I'm picturing Snuffleupagus.
Yeah. Snuffleupagus with a micro snout. The micro trunk. Yeah. Anyway, there are other ichnofossils in amongst these footprints. And an ichnofossil is just a general term that means trace fossil. So not an actual fossil of a creature, but a trace fossil like a footprint, but also burrows or poop or tracks or stuff like that. So these other ichnofossils include mammoth and canid, feline, bovid, and camelid species. So dog, cat, cow, and llama type species. Talking about a long time ago. Anyway, the journal Science, and I just, every time I say the journal Science, I kind of want to put an exclamation point on the end of it and make it sort of have this Broadway musical type flourish. Science.
The musical. Anyway.
Science, the musical.
I'm the surprised that's not a thing already.
Yeah, the journal Science, which is very, very well-respected journal, first reported the age of these footprints back in 2021 in an article with the first named of 12 researchers being Matthew Bennett. And the title of that article was Evidence for Humans in North America During the Last Glacial Maximum. And it is in this article that the researchers first made their claim that the footprints are 21 and 23,000 years old, noting that the fossil human footprints provide a good alternative source of evidence for human occupation. You can't deny that's a human, you know, because the footprints show it. So, and unlike cultural artifacts like bones or modified bones or more conventional fossils or tools, they have a very secure primary depositional context. You know, they're fixed on the imprinted surface. In other words, they just don't move around a lot. And so when they're excavated from an in situ sedimentary sequence, like they are at White Sands, they can give you a good chronological control. So the footprints were compared with a sample of similar tracks from Nambia, and they revealed broad similarities, including being flatter footed than we are today. And that's something that's quite common for people who don't wear shoes, for being unshod. So the footprints seem to be mostly of children and teenagers. There are some large adult footprints as well, but these are infrequent. And the researchers explain this by the possibility of a division of labor. So the adults would specialize in skilled tasks, and the youngsters were assigned to fetching and carrying tasks. So that's pretty, I think that's a good idea. That's kind of what, you know, people live like today, I guess. When they
How did they distinguish? I can, you know, it's fairly straightforward how they identify children's footprints, but how do they distinguish between teenager and adult footprints? Because I've had the same shoe size since about seventh grade.
I think they're just, I have no idea. I don't have an answer to that. I think they're just smaller than full adult footprints. Or maybe they have higher arches.
That would make sense, maybe, because the impressions, I don't know. All right, interesting.
Yeah, so youngsters, you know, doing more of the walking around. So in 2021, researchers dated these footprints using radiocarbon dating of seeds from an aquatic spiral tasselweed plant, a kind of ditchweed with the Latin name Rupia cirrhosa. So just a quick refresher on carbon-14 dating. All organic materials, plants and animals, contain carbon. One of these is the isotope carbon-14. And after the death of the organism, this decays at a steady rate, which can be measured, so you can tell how long ago it is since the thing died. So the dates for these seeds, these rupia seeds at White Sands, were 22,860,000 years ago, plus or minus 320 years, and 21,130 years ago, not thousands of years ago. I'm going to mess that up a bit. Let me start that part again. So the dates of these footprints from White Sands are 22,860 years ago, plus or minus 320 years, and 21,130 years ago, plus or minus 250 years. So in the article, they said they had accounted for any effects that hard water may have had on their findings. And I'll explain what that means in a minute. But they did believe that their radiocarbon dates were quite robust. Now, in addition, they also found mammoth tracks, which quietly support this much earlier date, because mammoths didn't live beyond the late Pleistocene.
Okay.
So one thing I found interesting is that when I was talking about those wood samples, they were much older, those African wood samples. They also showed that the same place was in use over thousands of years. So this is what we're also seeing at White Sands. So while this might seem quite cut and dried, the findings were not without their challenges. And this is fine. This is the nature of scientific inquiry. This is how knowledge grows, by somebody saying, I think this, and somebody says, well, go back and think about it again. And then this is what these people have done. So the first challenge was that the Rupia cirrhosa plant is an aquatic plant. And therefore, there's a potential that it can suck up old groundwater. So the plant potentially could be younger than the carbon in the groundwater it's sucked up. And so this is a phenomenon called the hard water effect. So this would potentially cause the seeds to look much older than they actually were under carbon testing dating. So the second challenge was that the Rupia cirrhosa seeds are physically quite tough and robust, and that they could be preserved in sediments and then churned up again from older deposits and reincorporated in new sediments in these footprints. So if this was the case, all we could really say is that the footprints can be no older than 23,000 years, not that they actually are 23,000 years. So the team of researchers has gone about strengthening their dating claims. And so they've used other dating techniques, other sample types, and a different lab than they used in the first study. And it's these results that were reported this last week in another article in the journal Science, called Independent Age Estimates Reduce Controversy. Independent Age Estimates Resolve the Controversy of Ancient Human Footprints at White Sands. And the first named author on this is Jeffrey Pigati. And when I looked at it, what I realized they'd done is on the first article, they'd placed all the authors in alphabetical order. And on the second article, they'd placed them in reverse alphabetical order, which I just think is very cute and collegiate. And for some reason, the non-rational part of my brain makes me believe them even more because they've done this. Yes, because I'm a very serious academic.
Well, there is something nice about the idea that they would sort of, I don't think egalitarianize is a word, or it probably will be, you know, some grad student will probably use it in a paper next year and it'll be a word, but they've taken that step to be like, we're all doing equal labor. Like, let's acknowledge each other. I don't know if that's what they were doing, but it's a nice idea.
Anyway, to their new evidence, the first thing they tested was terrestrial pollen. And so this is pollen that comes from plants that grow on the earth, not in water, so not aquatic, and so not subject to any possible hard water effects. But there is a small problem with testing pollen, or rather a problem of being small. Pollen grains are tiny and lightweight, and so this means that you need more than one pollen grain to get a radiocarbon date. You actually need tens or even hundreds. And it's very difficult to isolate enough pollen grains from other organic matter. So if any other organic matter is left, this may throw off the radiocarbon 14 dating. But a technique called flow cytometry has overcome this problem and been able to provide almost pure pollen samples. So the technique of flow cytometry has been around since the 1950s with a guy called Mac Fulweiler developing the forerunner of today's flow cytometers in the 1960s, who also published in the journal Science. And I just got to say, you know, this technique is amazing. I'm just so blown away that we can do this. And so what happens in flow cytometry is that the substance to be tested is placed in a fluid. And then the purpose of this is just to let one cell or one particle or one piece of pollen out at a time. And then this is sort of blasted by a laser, and what you're looking for is the light scatter from the laser, and all the different cells and particles, and in this case terrestrial pollen, have a different scatter pattern. It's like a fingerprint. So you can tell what it is. You can tell what kind of cell or particle or piece of pollen it is, and tens of thousands of these can be examined at one time. And the other great thing about flow cytometry today is that it can also sort the various things. You're only getting one tiny thing out at a time, and it can push them into different baskets. So what you can do is like send the material through and get a little basket that just has the pollen in. So then this can be tested for radiocarbon 14 dating. So flow cytometry is very useful in clinical trials, and in things like diagnosing blood cancer, that kind of thing is what it's usually used for.
Interesting.
Yeah. Or it can be used for sorting out teeny tiny pollen samples to get a radiocarbon 14 date. So the researchers did this with samples of bulk sediment from the same stratigraphic levels as those original rupia seeds, and they found date ranges from 22,870 years ago, plus or minus 300 years, and 21,130 years ago, plus or minus 250 years. So I'm not expecting you to remember the older dates, but these are exactly the same. There's just 10 years difference in the older date. So 22,870 for the pollen and 22,860 for the rupia seeds. And then the younger date, 21,130 years ago, is exactly the same. And this is just amazing to me. You know,
yeah. This
seems very, very much proof positive. All right, I'll send you another invite.
Okay, I'm going to pay.
Okay. Me too.